Hi, my name is Dory, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Dory. My sobriety date is October 20th, 2004. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. So, I've spoken in churches before, but this is very, very different. So, I grew up in New Jersey. I am the oldest of two, and I come from a very, very big extended family. There, any kind of addiction that you could possibly think of is in my family. I can't remember exactly when I had my first drink because I was always allowed to drink. There was no age limit. I do remember when I was five, they had a big party, and there was a little bit of alcohol in everybody's drinks, and I ran around and just finished it all off. But in my family, this is completely acceptable and normal. The first time that the magic happened is when I was 11 years old. I was in sixth grade. I was always so shy and introverted. I was that kid in school who never wanted to raise their hand or, God forbid, be called on or spoken to in any way, shape, or form. I always knew that I was defective. There was something wrong with me, and I just didn't fit in with everybody else. But I took that drink of alcohol, and all of a sudden, it was like magic. I finally, for the first time in my life, completely fit in. I was funny, and I was talkative, and I remember sitting there, and I had my hands like this, and my arms kept falling, because I wasn't in great shape by this point, and everybody thought I was so funny. I've never had this experience before, and I'm like, I'm going to do this a lot. You know, I finally fit in. So I really loved school because growing up in an alcoholic family can either be a lot of fun because we had great parties where everybody would be drinking and dancing, or there was a fist fight and the cops were called. You never knew exactly which one it was going to be. So school to me became my sanctuary. It was the only place that I could go and get consistent results for doing certain things. If you do your homework, you normally get a good grade. It was pretty simple. So I progressed along using as much as I possibly could. Then by the time I got into high school, my mom decided that she was going to get remarried. She had divorced my dad. He was an alcoholic, and, you know, I'll talk more about my dad later. So we moved to this place called North Arlington. Now, I'm in high school. High school is not the easiest time to move. I'm a sophomore. So that is where I met Cynthia. Cynthia was my very best friend in high school. And for those of you that really know Cynthia, you can imagine the trouble we got into. So, you know, drunk Cynthia, not sober Cynthia. So we had a lot of fun together, partied a lot. You see, in my house, you could come to my house. It was acceptable even at 15 years old to drink and, quite frankly, do whatever you wanted in my house. There was no such thing as rules. So I graduated high school at 17. By this time, two family members of mine had died. One was killed right underneath going into the Lincoln Tunnel, drunk driving, flipped his car over, completely annihilated. My second uncle died here in New York. He worked for the New York Times, and his life took him to, he died, and no one cared because he was all alone, and they found him because it smelled. So this is my normal childhood growing up. And I graduate high school, and I'm off to college. See, I decided I was going to be nothing like my family. I was one of the first people in my entire family, and I have a huge family, to ever graduate high school. Most of them had to quit and help support the family. So I was going to college, and I was going to be different. I learned to talk different. I dressed different. I did everything that I possibly could different because I wasn't going to wind up like them. Their lives were a mess. I had family members in jail, divorced. I mean, my family was a mess. So I tried to change everything, and unfortunately, I wasn't doing a really good job of it because by the time I enter college, I am a full-blown alcoholic, and I know there's something wrong with me. And I thought I was just crazy, you know, and maybe it's that hole I still have inside of me that I just can't seem to drink away, to do other things, and I can't make it go away. So I had met this boy when I was 15 down the shore, and this is how I make my decisions. The reason I liked him is because he had beer that I had never heard of, and he was legal to buy beer. This is how I make my decision of who I want to have in my life. So this boy all of a sudden shows back up at my house, and he looks really different. And I am 19 years old. It's 1985. And I'm like, what happened to you? He said, I'm sober. I'm like, what? Okay. And he's like, well, do you want to go to a meeting? Because now we're talking, because we had corresponded from time to time. And he's like, maybe you have a problem. I said, sure. You know, I'll go to an AA meeting. What the heck? You know, he's a cute boy. So he takes me to my first meeting, introduces me to some women, and leaves. Like, this is not what I was expecting to happen, you know? So I'm not really convinced at this point. I'm only 19 years old. You know, I'm a college student. I'm you know, getting fantastic grades because I always did good in school. I'm working three jobs. You know, I'm thinking maybe I'm not, but okay, let's try it. So it was suggested I change people, places, and things. Well, I would have none of that. You know, I didn't want to make any changes in my life. And I decided to go out with my friend, and I drank, and I thought I could handle it. You know, I was put in situations where being newly sober, I couldn't handle it. I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't following any suggestions other than my own. And it made me think, you know, something's wrong. Maybe they're right. Because I had gone to some meetings at this point. So I decided I really wanted to get sober. So I go to my first AA meeting, really wanting to get sober now, in Kearney, New Jersey. And I get a sponsor. And this woman was tough. Her alcoholism had taken her to the point that she had become a prostitute. And when I looked at her, I saw a mom with children and a happy marriage, and I couldn't imagine any of these things when I heard her share her story. And she knew I was shy and I couldn't talk. So she made me do all these things like clean ashtrays, and I was annoyed. You know, I didn't want to interact with people. I wanted to show up, go to a meeting, and leave, and that was it. I didn't want to talk to anybody. But what she was doing for me, by putting me into service, she was forcing me to look at people. Eventually, you start to see the same people. You know, all of our sponsors who were cleaning ashtrays at that time, our sponsors were making us do it. And eventually, I started making eye contact. And you see the same people over and over. And then it's hi. You know, when you start talking to people. And that's how she started to get me involved in the program. And she said to me, you know, you have to change some things in your life. You know, you have to stop hanging out with the same people and doing the same things. But see, I wanted to rescue everyone. I dragged Cynthia to an AA meeting because I was going to save her, because I found this wonderful gift and I was going to share it with everyone. I have been to almost every addiction group that you can imagine, dragging my entire family saying, but you don't understand, this is great. You know, you got to do this. I took Cynthia, which she doesn't remember a lot of this stuff, which I was actually very offended by. You know, I dragged her to a drug and alcohol counselor, which she doesn't remember, because see, if I can't get through to her, then, you know, maybe they can. And I lived in a place, now I still live at home, I'm in college. So, you know, I got sober in a house where people were drinking constantly, where they couldn't call me an alcoholic because I was the golden child. You see, I graduated high school, I'm in college, I'm, you know, working all these jobs. You possibly can't be an alcoholic. You know, so I live in a house where everyone was trying to undermine me because that put a scar on their perfect child. You know, they would do things like have family functions and say, oh, we forgot you're an alcoholic. We happened to put alcohol in there. But I still stayed sober. And I had to change a lot of things. And I remember saying to Cynthia, you know, I can't be friends with you. I can't hang out with you anymore. And I had to change everything in my life. That first Christmas I spent at my sponsor's house because I knew what my house was going to be like. You know, I immersed myself in the fellowship. She made me work steps. She made me chair meetings, you know, and then it was 3-month commitments to chair a meeting. She made me chair a women's meeting. And I had to get there early, set up, do all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay. And at that time, there were not a lot of young people in AA. You know, I feel like I'm a child. And, you know, it's comical because, you know, I'm almost 50 now. And I look and I looked around at all these 40-year-old people and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, if you want what we have, I'm like, you're 40, you're old. What could you possibly have that I want? But I did want to be sober. So my life is going along fantastic. I managed to stay sober. I get married to that boy because he stayed sober too. And we bought a house and I had three children and everything looked great. But see, we moved. And when we bought our house and I moved far away from my group, and I'm like, I'm not going to go to meetings. I'm okay. You know, I'm sober for a while now, right? I'm fine. Yeah, not really. I remember the day he came in and I said, I have two choices. I'm either going to an AA meeting or a mental institution, and I'm not really sure which one I need. Because all of those character defects and all of that stuff, it doesn't go away. You know, I have to continually work at my sobriety and my spirituality. It's not you just do it and you get it forever. It doesn't work that way. So I went back to AA, thank God, and I was able to stay sober. So our life is going along fantastic. He gets promoted and we're moving to Florida. So I'm really excited. We moved to Florida. Now I have everything that I ever wanted financially, emotionally. Everything is just perfect in my life. I move into this big house. Wonderful. But I moved again. So I don't really need meetings, I don't think, right? And I go along and I stay dry for a while. But all of a sudden, now I'm in my 30s, and my neighbors are saying to me, Dory, you look fine. You can't possibly be an alcoholic. How can you make that decision at 19 years old? You were a child. That's what everybody does in college. We were probably actually worse than you were. So we really don't think you're an alcoholic. And I remember talking to my husband at the time about this, and he's like, yeah, maybe, because he got, you know, sober young too. Maybe they're right. So I don't believe in slips. For me, it was absolutely premeditated. I would have these fantasies like the Calgon commercial, you know. I could see me in the bathtub with a sexy glass of wine, you know, because now I have money. I'm not drinking Boone's Farm and Michelob anymore, you know. So I thought that, you know, because I fixed all that stuff, I wasn't that same person anymore. I wasn't that scared little girl anymore. And if I have pretty crystal glasses and really expensive wine or vodka, then I'm okay, right? So I had taken him on a vacation to Chicago, and he loved golf. He wanted to see Tiger Woods, so I planned this whole thing out. And we go to this restaurant, and he says, I'm ordering a bottle of wine, and I'm going to drink it, and you can or not. And I said, okay. It was that simple. That simple. Because, see, I'm in a fancy restaurant now, drinking nice wine. I'm okay. And I remember one of my first thoughts, which should have been a clue, was, how long do you have to wait to drink again and not be an alcoholic? Like, normal people don't think like that, you know? Not after their first drink, you know? But that was my mindset. Right away, the wheels start going. So now we're both using. So you can imagine it's not real pretty when you have two alcoholics, active alcoholics in the same house. And I did wait. It was actually 3 weeks before I had my next glass of wine, and it got worse and worse and worse. During this time, my cousin, who was 26, overdosed, and I was very, very close to him. It wasn't intentional. It was accidental. Too much mixing of stuff with alcohol. And I was devastated. And I didn't stop me from drinking, though. I kept on. My marriage is falling apart. I'm miserable. I am alone. And I am so sad. Everything looks great on the outside because I'm really good at that. You know, I can fake it and pretend like everything looks okay on the outside, but on the inside, I was dying, absolutely dying. So then we decide to move to Omaha, Nebraska, which You know, I'm like, okay, we're moving to Omaha. Because, see, his drinking is kind of getting in the way at work, and he's really messing up bad. I don't know a lot of this stuff that's going on. But we moved to Omaha, Nebraska. So I decided, I think I lived there about a year, that I wanted a divorce. You know, our marriage was a wreck, and I'm doing things like locking myself in the room because I can't come out and have my children knocking on my door saying, Mommy, please come out. And I can't. You know, I just can't. I just wanted to be alone. I just wanted to drink. I just wanted to numb out. And see, now I know better because I had been sober for 15 years, you know? And I'm sitting in my bathroom every night because now I'm doing other things and I'm smoking cigarettes because for me, everything all goes together. When one addiction comes out, they all come together. So, you know, I'm sitting in, I had this huge mirror and I would sit on the sink smoking cigarettes, drinking and other things. And I would say to myself, tomorrow, you know what? Tomorrow I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit drinking, doing other things, and I'm going to stop smoking cigarettes. All of this is going to be tomorrow. So tomorrow doesn't come, and I don't know how I'm going to stop drinking because I can't now. I have all these rules. You see, you're allowed to drink after 5 o'clock unless you're on the golf course or if you're dirt bike racing. Then you can do those things before 5 o'clock. And so I have all these rules about drinking, which makes me a non-alcoholic. Because, see, this is how I'm justifying my behavior. You could do other things before 5 o'clock, but drinking has to be at 5 o'clock or you're an alcoholic. So my husband is away on the business trip, and I am smashed. And he calls me, and he says, I know you're wasted. I know you're high. You filed for divorce. I'm calling the cops. They're going to arrest you, and you're going to lose your kids. And I was like, wow, okay. You know what? Now this got really real, really fast, you know, because I don't care if I die. You know, the reason I want to stay alive is because I can't leave my children motherless. I care more about their lives than I care about mine. So the next day I called an AA hotline and got where the meeting was. And I went to my first AA meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. But see, this time I know what to do. I know I have to get a sponsor. I know I have to talk. I know I have to work the steps. And it was easy. You know, step one is easy. I am obviously powerless, and my life is incredibly unmanageable because I could lose my children. You know, I'm definitely insane, and I don't care what power it is. I don't know where I stand at this point with God or higher power, but I know it's not me. And if I don't have to do this alone, I am good. So I remember going into that meeting, and it felt like a big warm blanket just wrapped around me. I knew I was okay. And my sponsor got me working on steps right away. And she helped me walk through that divorce with grace and dignity. You know, it was an ugly, nasty divorce, and she made me do the right thing, or suggested, you know, I do certain things. And I actually listened. I was willing. I was so empty and sad and alone that I was willing to do anything at this point to not feel this way anymore. You see, alcohol and anything, I mean anything, shopping, food, anything that I do in excess outside myself, that's not my problem. That's my solution. Alcohol is my solution. I'm the problem. I have a hole inside of me that I just can't get enough of anything. So I'm always looking outside. And my sponsor didn't let me do mean things, vindictive things. She made me act principled, or suggested I acted principled, and I was angry. I did not want to act principled because he wasn't acting principled. So two wrongs, you know, I think that's fair. And she said, no, no, because you know what? Those are the things that will get you drunk. Maybe not today, but eventually those are the things that will get you drunk. You know, fourth and fifth step were fairly easy for me because I thought everything was my fault and I thought everything was wrong with me because I was defective from day one. So, you know, I didn't have an issue with resentments or things I did wrong, inventory of myself. But I didn't see the real me, not yet. You know, I didn't see that I was a liar and that I was a cheater and I was a manipulator and I was a control freak and I was extremely self-centered because I had this saintly thing. I'm the perfect wife. I'm the perfect mother. It was a bunch of bull. Everything revolved around me in my head, in my world, extremely self-centered. And then, you know, on to the list of amends. And I had, you know, these people I'm willing to, these people possibly, and there were three people on my never, ever, no way. Because you know what? I may have done things wrong, but I can tell you they did things way worse than me. And never, never, never. I can tell you today, there's no one that's a never. I finally, after working steps and staying sober for a period of time, there's no one on that never list because I see my part. You know, I didn't see the things with my ex-husband. You know, I didn't see that my children were everything and he became nothing. I didn't see that when I got sober, against my sponsor's suggestion, I got involved in a relationship, which I do not suggest, but I did. And, you know, that person basically was living in my home, in his home. I didn't see anything wrong with this at the time because I was scared. You know, that had to be really hurtful. I didn't see my part in any of those things, you know, because it was all about me. And this year, I made an amends to someone who wasn't even on the list because I didn't even think about him. It was my dad. You know, my dad was an alcoholic. My dad was a disaster. He left. He left us, you know, and my parents got divorced in a time when people didn't get divorced. So I was ostracized as a child, you know, because I had a divorced family when I was younger. And he just bailed and left us. And he's an alcoholic and he's a mess. I confronted him when I first got sober at 19, and it wasn't really spiritual, and it was definitely not something I should have done, but I did. And I didn't talk to my dad for 15 years. 15 years. And I called him. And I said, I'd like to see you. He says, okay. So I go there, and he is a wreck. He is nervous. He is chain smoking, and my dad should not be smoking. He was a mess. And I said to him, I just wanted to tell you I'm sorry, and I wasn't the best daughter. And I said nothing about any of the pain that he caused. It was all about the things that I did. You know, for me, that's what a making amends is about, you know, is taking my own inventory and making it right. And today, other than those three people, if God willing, they, you know, God gives me an opportunity, I will make amends to those people. But there's no one on that never list. And today, my higher power is incredibly important to me. I can't say I understand. You know, I had things all confused about religion and spirituality, and it was just too much for my little head to comprehend. You know, I know that there's something, and I know it's not me, and that's good enough. You know, I still look at myself as a seeker. I meditate. I didn't know what meditation was, so I learned how to do that. And I actively participate in service and sponsoring other women and helping other women. You know, I had with my children, an example of, you know, acceptance and letting go. I used to have, it's either on page 449 or 417, depending on what big book you have, I used to have it posted all around the place because I really struggled with acceptance and letting go. And I thought I knew what letting go was. My oldest son, I had to ask him to leave when he was 18 years old because he dropped out of college, refused to get a job, and he was using, and I knew it, and I had other children in the house, and it was incredibly painful. Now, I had dragged these poor kids. I mean, they were drug tested. They were dragged to AA meetings. I mean, you know, that was their punishment, you know, when they, you know, did things they weren't supposed to be doing. So I thought that my son would come to me for help. You know, I'm sober. I'm a good member of AA, and he didn't. He went to his father, who is in recovery, again, as well. And my son cut me out of his life. And, you know, back home they say he sopranoed me. You know, I was dead to him. And I couldn't understand that, see, even in sobriety, if I'm not working a program and being honest and talking to my sponsor, I could still act as crazy as I did when I was using. And I went at him with anger and tried to control and force him to be in my life. And he didn't take well to that. And, you know, I thought when people would say, oh, I have such a pain, you know, I, you know, this hurts so bad, I would be like, well, you're probably being a little bit over dramatic. You feel physical pain. Well, I learned the hard way. Yeah, I felt physical pain. And he didn't want anything to do with me until one day I finally got the chance to talk to him. And I said, you know what? I just want you to be happy and I want you to be sober. And I hope someday I can be part of that. But if not, that's okay. I understand. This is your path, not mine. And I have no right to try to control or force my way into your life. So I'm happy to say today that my son is about to celebrate 4 years of sobriety. And I will be invited for the first time to see him get his chip. You know, my son calls me all the time. He wants to know about my sobriety. He wants to share in my life. Mom, what do you think about this? Mom, I went to this meeting and I heard this. Mom, have you ever experienced that? And we can share this commonality. My two other children are in different places. My daughter, you know, she may be one of us. I can't take her inventory, but I'm still hopeful for her. But we still have a good relationship inside of that, because one of the things I learned about my children is I can't control them either. I gave birth to them and I love them unconditionally, but I have no control over their life or what they choose to do. And all I can do is pray that they have happiness in their life and nothing more, and just be open and available to them. You know, my youngest son decided at 14 to go live with his dad because he came to me and said, Mom, I've lived with you my whole life. I mean, he's 14 years old, you know, his whole life. And he said, I don't remember living with my dad and I want to get to know him. So I said, okay. And I have a wonderful relationship, because not living with him now, he thinks I'm pretty awesome, you know? I don't have to tell him to do his homework. He's not getting drug tested, and life is pretty good for him. So, you know, I have a life today that is incredible, and it's because of AA. You know, I have a job today that, you know, I speak a lot. You know, I actually teach for a corporation. This is a girl who couldn't raise her hand in class. That's because of AA. It's because I have to do things like this that make me incredibly uncomfortable that I can be successful in my job today. I have good relationships with almost everyone today. I'm not really creating new wreckage today, which is a good thing. You know, I can do all kinds of things that you can't do drunk. When I got sober, I learned how to ski. I became a certified scuba diver. I've ridden dirt bikes. I've jumped out of airplanes. Not recommended when you're drinking, you know? So, I mean, I have a life today that I get to experience wonderful things and be fearless. You know, that's what courage is. Courage doesn't mean you don't have fear. If you don't have fear, you don't need courage. Fear, doing things in spite of your fear, that's what courage is. You know, in our serenity prayer. And today I have courage to do things even when I'm afraid. But that's because I have a whole group of women standing behind me, cheering me on, saying, you got this. You're okay. It's going to be just fine. And when I fall on my face, they go, well, maybe not the best, but we still love you. And it's, and you know what? It's okay. You know, so I do have a life that's not perfect, but that is beyond my wildest dreams in every regard. You know, that little girl in New Jersey who thought she was so broken and defective, you know, I may still be somewhat defective. I'm a work in progress, you know. It never promises that I'm going to get better. And I think if I ever think I'm better, I'm probably in trouble and my sponsor will tap me on the head. You know, it's work in progress, and it's exciting there are so many things that I have the opportunity to do sober. So that's all I have. Thank you for letting me share.